Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lost and Found by Jane Ann Krentz, narrated by Dara Rosenberg.
1. It is never wise to become emotionally involved with a client, Vestabrick said. I'm not involved with Mac Easton. Katie cradled the phone against her shoulder and tugged off first one high heel and then the other. Not in the way you mean. I'm just consulting for him. I thought I made that clear. There was a short, terse silence on the other end of the line. Katie sighed silently and sank down onto the sofa. The phone had been ringing a moment ago when she had come through the door. She had lunged for it on the off chance that it was Fantasy Man. It had not been Mac Easton. It had been her great aunt. There's something in your voice when you talk about him, Vesta said. Icicles of disapproval hung on each word. I get the impression that you are interested in him in a personal way. He's just a voice on the phone. But what a voice. Every time she heard it, a thrill of awareness zinged through each nerve ending. Her vivid imagination did the rest, conjuring blatantly erotic fantasies out of thin air. It was a voice that had begun to whisper in her dreams, but she saw no reason to mention that to her rigid great-aunt. Vesta Briggs was not a romantic. Katie slipped off one silver earring and set it down on the glass-topped coffee table. Probably not a good idea to tell Vesta that in addition to being a voice on the phone, Easton had also become a frequent email correspondent, she thought. He seemed to enjoy locating arcane bits and pieces of information relating to the art world online and forwarding them on to her. Lately, she could have sworn that he had begun to flirt with her via computer. She saved all of his online correspondence in a special folder labeled Fantasy Man. She'd gotten in the habit of checking her computer first thing each morning to see if he had paid her an online visit during the night. She didn't want to use the word obsessive to describe her new routine, but she was aware that some people might view it as a tad compulsive. Of course, if there was anyone who would understand obsession, it was Vesta, she thought. She glanced at the row of family photographs arranged on one wall. Her gaze fell on the woman with dark hair and enigmatic eyes. It had been taken some 50 years ago when her great-aunt was in her 30s, shortly after she had founded Gallery Chatelaine. There was a withdrawn, remote quality about the image. Vesta looked as if she was listening to a conversation that only she could hear, one that had taken place in the distant past. As far as anyone knew, the only thing Vesta had ever cared about was Chatelaine's. There had been no room in her life for love or marriage or children. For 5 decades, she had single-handedly controlled the fate of the business she had created. With unflinching determination, skill and vision, she had brought her gallery to its current respected position in the art world. But her lifelong preference for privacy could no longer conceal her growing eccentricities. A lot of people were convinced that Katie took after Vesta. Lately, Katie had begun to worry about that possibility herself. It was true that, in spite of Vesta's austere personality, she had always felt a deep attachment to her. It wasn't just because her great-aunt had taught her everything she knew about the art and antiques business. The feeling of unspoken understanding between the two women went deeper. Even as a child, Katie had sensed some deep, long-buried pain beneath the layers of protective frost that Vesta wore like an invisible shroud. "Easton is a good client," Katie said, trying hard to inject reassurance into her words. "What's more, I'm really enjoying this end of the business."
"Tracing lost and stolen art and antiques?"
Vesta paused.
"I can see why that might appeal to you. You always were more adventurous than Sylvia."
"Which is why Sylvia makes a much better CEO for Gallery Chatelaine than I ever could," Katie said quickly. "She thrives on that corporate stuff."
"And you don't?"
Vesta sounded resigned. "No." Katie settled deeper into the sofa. "I'm happy with my little art consulting business. I wasn't cut out to run a large operation like Chatelaine's. We both know that.
You may change your mind someday.
No. This was old territory. It had been well covered after Katie's divorce 3 years ago. There was more silence on the line.
Be careful, Vesta said after a while. Don't allow yourself to be seduced by this new client of yours.
Seduced? Katie repeated in a strangled voice, unable to believe what she had heard. Vesta never discussed sex. I told you, I haven't even met him.
There's often a great deal of money at stake when it comes to art. You know that as well as I do. A man who requires your expertise to get his hands on that cash cannot be trusted. It sounds like your Mr. Easton finds you useful.
That's the whole point of my art consulting business, to make myself useful.
It's all well and good for a client to find you useful, but don't let yourself be used. There's a difference.
Good grief, Aunt Vesta. It's not like I'm having a red-hot affair with the man.
Unfortunately, she added to herself.
Yes, well, that's enough on the subject of Mac Easton. I didn't call just to discuss him, Vesta said.
Good. I also wanted you to know that I'm having second thoughts about the wisdom of a merger with Austri Post.
Deeply relieved by the change of topic, Katie swung her legs up onto the sofa and leaned back in the corner. Sylvia told me that you had mentioned you might postpone the vote on the proposal.
I haven't made a final decision yet, but I will soon.
Vesta paused.
I just thought you should know.
I'm no longer a member of the board, Katie reminded her. I won't be voting.
I'm aware of that. Nevertheless, I think you should stay informed.
Sylvia is not a happy camper, Katie said carefully.
I know. She wants the merger to go through.
She's got a vision for the gallery, Aunt Vesta.
Yes.
It's a great vision, one that will make Gallery Chatelaine even more important in the art world than it is already.
Yes.
There was something in Vesta's voice that told Katie there was more to the story, but she knew her aunt well enough to know that there was no point pushing for an explanation. Besides, this was Sylvia's problem.
Did you go out tonight? Vesta asked.
Another change of subject. Interesting. I went to the preview of the Kenner collection, Katie said.
Oh, yes, that's right. I remember that you mentioned it. I expect that it was well attended. The sharks of the art world have been circling for years, waiting for Anna Kenner to expire.
Her collection of 18th and 19th century decorative arts is one of the finest in the country. Well, the good news is that Mrs. Kenner managed to outlive several of the sharks. She was 97 when she died.
Good for her. I always did like Anna.
She bought some of her best pieces from me several years ago.
Yes, I know.
She hired me to consult after I moved here to Santa Barbara. I liked her. Tonight, Anna Kenner's Santa Barbara mansion had been filled with scavengers dressed in formal attire. They had come to view the lady's personal possessions in preparation for tomorrow night's auction. Anna's heirs had little interest in the lovely English porcelains, Georgian silver, chinoiserie panels, and exquisite furniture she had accumulated in her lifetime. They were anxious to convert her worldly goods into cash as quickly and profitably as possible. The denizens of the art world had been equally eager to help them accomplish that goal. Katie had spent most of the evening standing in an alcove, an untouched flute of champagne in one hand. She had watched the dealers, consultants, museum curators, and private collectors prowl through the fine rooms. People had paused here and there to examine carefully arranged groupings of art and antiques, and to make inquiries about provenance and value. The auction house representatives, also garbed in somber black and white, had stood discreetly nearby to supply answers and advice. It had all been very civilized and quite elegant, with a proper air of hushed solemnity, Katie thought. But she could not suppress the sense of melancholia that swirled up out of the depths. She ought to know better. The ritual was a familiar one. She had grown up in the art world. She was well aware that there was little place for sentiment when it came to the business of auctioning off a valuable collection. But tonight, the process of preparing for what was essentially a high-end garage sale had been tinged with sadness. She had a right to brood, she thought. Anna Kenner had been more than a client. She had become a friend. The good news is that Anna was wined and dined in style during the last few years, Katie said. I think she rather enjoyed it.
I certainly hope so, Vesta said dryly. I doubt if there was any expense spared to secure that consignment.
None. The big auction houses sent people out from New York. The locals also spent a fortune on her. She told me that the courtship began while she was still in her early 80s. Who could know she would live so long? Like other wealthy collectors in her position, Anna Kenner had received the royal treatment from dealers, consultants, and curators during the last years of her life. Her birthdays had been celebrated with elaborate floral arrangements from auction houses. Her evenings had been filled with invitations to lavish gallery openings and museum receptions. As she had once told Katie, her dance card was always full. It was ambulance chasing with class, Katie thought, but it was, nevertheless, ambulance chasing.
Well, it's getting late, Vesta said. I'm going to take my swim and then go to bed.
Good night, Katie. There was something not quite right here, Katie thought. This was not a typical Vesta phone call. Aunt Vesta?
Yes?
Is anything wrong?
What makes you think there's something wrong?
Vesta asked crisply. Katie winced. It's not like you to call without a very specific reason.
I explained my reasons for calling. I wanted to warn you about getting too cozy with Easton and to let you know that I was reconsidering the merger.
I see. Mac Easton and the merger didn't seem to warrant a late-night phone call, Katie thought. But with Vesta, you could never be sure what was going on beneath the surface. She wondered if her aunt was simply lonely. Aunt Vesta?
What is it now?
I love you. There was a short, startled pause on the other end of the line. Katie braced herself. Vesta was not given to sentiment.
I love you too, Katie, Vesta said.
The words sounded stiff and rusty, as if she'd dredged them up from deep underground. Katie was so stunned she nearly fell off the sofa.
We are so much alike, you and I, Vesta continued. But I hope things will turn out differently for you.
Katie tried to collect her thoughts.
Differently?
I hope you will be happy, Vesta said with stark simplicity. Good night, Katie. The line went dead. Katie sat with the phone in her hand until it started to make strange sounds. She hung up the receiver, got to her feet, collected her shoes, and went slowly down the hall to her bedroom. There she unzipped the subdued cowl-necked dress she had worn to the preview. She pulled on a pair of black tights and a leotard and went barefooted down the hall into the living room. She switched on some Mozart and stood quietly for a moment. When she was ready, she went slowly through the yoga exercises that she had practiced faithfully since college. It had been suggested by more than one acquaintance that she was a little obsessive about her daily workout. But she was convinced that it was the flowing, stretching movements combined with the deep breathing techniques that allowed her to control her body's predisposition toward panic attacks, a predisposition she had inherited from Vesta's side of the family. She was careful about her routine, but just to be on the safe side, she kept a tiny pill wrapped in tissue inside the small case attached to her key ring. She had not had to resort to the little tablet in years, but there was a certain sense of security in knowing that it was available if she ever got overwhelmed by the terrible jitters. She thought about it during that significant pause that occurs between the closing of an elevator's doors and the first movement of the cab. She visualized it when she found herself sitting in an airplane that had been delayed on the ground for an extended period of time. Most of all, she contemplated it whenever someone tried to coax her into going swimming in a lake or the ocean or any other body of water where she could not see beneath the surface. The problem with panic attacks was just one more trait that she shared with Vesta, she thought, as she curved into a slow, arching movement that released the tension in her shoulder. She had heard the comments for years. "You're just like your aunt. You take after your aunt. You have your aunt's eye for art and antiques." But she and Vesta were at opposite poles when it came to the subject of deep water. To the best of Katie's knowledge, her 86-year-old aunt had swum almost every day of her adult life. Vesta loved the water. She'd had a large pool installed on the terrace of her home near Sausalito in Marin County, California. She was especially fond of swimming alone at night in the dark. It occurred to Katie that she was as compulsive about her yoga as Vesta was about her nightly swim. Something else they had in common. Sometimes she wanted to scream in frustration, but there was no denying that the comparisons between herself and her aunt were growing more acute as each year passed. The parallels were getting a little scary. After her infamous 9-day marriage blew up in her face, she'd heard murmurs to the effect that she had also inherited Vesta's inability to deal with the male of the species. The words, "You're gonna end up just like Aunt Vesta," had taken on new meaning during the past 3 years. Lately, even her parents, usually serenely absorbed in their academic careers, had started to become concerned. After the divorce, they had developed an irritating habit of making polite but increasingly pointed inquiries into Katie's social life. She unfolded herself from the last exercise and sat cross-legged, gazing out into the night. The strains of a concerto spilled over her and through her, veiling the shadowy spaces that she knew from long experience were better off left unexplored. Genetic inheritances were tough, but nature wasn't everything, she reminded herself. Self-determination played a role, too. She was not a Vesta Bricks clone. If she worked hard, she could avoid developing Vesta's less appealing characteristics. She would not become a self-absorbed loner who surrounded herself with the visible evidence of the past. Damn, she was still brooding, in spite of the Mozart and yoga. Maybe a frozen pizza and a glass of wine would do the trick. What she really needed tonight was a distraction, she thought. Preferably another one of the fascinating, out-of-the-ordinary consulting assignments she had started accepting from Fantasy Man. There had been 3 jobs in the past 2 months, each one more interesting and more intriguing than the last. Mac Easton had tracked her down via the internet. The only thing she knew for certain about him was that he operated a very low-profile online business he called Lost and Found. Driven by curiosity, she had tried to research him and his business online, but the usual search engines had come up empty-handed. "You didn't find Mac Easton, apparently. He found you." Easton brokered information related to lost, strayed, and stolen art. As far as she could discern, his clients included a wide variety of private collectors, museums, and galleries. They all had 2 things in common. They wanted help tracing and recovering art, antiques, or antiquities, and for various reasons, they did not want to take their problems to the police. Easton worked by referral only. In his initial phone call, he had explained that he frequently required consulting assistance from experts who had specialized knowledge. That was where Katie came in. She knew the world of the so-called decorative arts, the realm where exquisite design and functionality intersected. She loved the objects and artifacts of the past that had been crafted with an eye toward both beauty and practicality. Glorious Baroque salt cellars, gleaming 17th-century inkwells created by master silversmiths, glowing French tapestries, brilliantly illustrated wall panels, and handmade furniture. Those were the things that called to her across the centuries. Purists could have their fine art, their paintings and sculpture and the like. She was drawn to art that had been shaped to a useful purpose, art that satisfied the needs of daily life as well as the senses. She closed her eyes and summoned up the mental image she had constructed to go with Easton's voice. As always, the picture refused to gel. Probably because no man could live up to that fantastic voice, she thought. It's all well and good for a client to find you useful, but don't let yourself be used. If she hadn't known better, Katie thought. She would have suspected that her aunt was speaking from personal experience. But that was impossible. No one used Aunt Vesta. The phone rang, jarring her out of her reverie. She hesitated briefly and then uncoiled to her feet and crossed the crimson carpet. She paused, her hand hovering over the instrument, and listened to the second and third ring. Her parents were in England at the moment, doing research for their next papers in art history. But the fact that they were several thousand miles away did not mean that they weren't calling to ask about her boring love life. She really did not need that conversation tonight, not after Vesta's call. The phone rang a fourth time. She could let it go into voicemail. But what if it was Fantasy Man? The odds were staggeringly not in favor of that possibility, but the slim chance that it was Easton calling with another consulting assignment was sufficient incentive to make her scoop up the phone. Hello?
What do you know about 16th century armor? Fantasy Man asked.
Oh, boy. The voice cued every nerve ending in her body. Get a grip, woman. He's probably married. Voices like this one do not stay single for long. Or maybe he's 20 or 30 years older than you are. So what? Maturity was a good quality in a man. Funny you should ask, she said, striving for a businesslike tone. Mentally, she crossed her fingers behind her back. Okay, so arms and armor were in her favorite examples of the decorative arts. Nevertheless, she knew the basics. More importantly, she knew whom to call to bring her up to speed in a hurry. She had connections at some of the best museums and galleries in the country.
I think we should meet to talk about the assignment, Fantasy Man said. There are some complications involved.
This was the first time he had ever suggested that they should get together face to face. Don't get too excited here. It's just a job. Yes, of course, she said. Where do you want to meet?
At the client's place of business.
She seized a pen. Where is it?
Las Vegas, Fantasy Man said. Place called Military World. A small museum that features reproductions of arms and armor from the medieval period to the present. Does a big gift shop business.
Reproductions? She repeated carefully. Her initial enthusiasm evaporated instantly. Reality returned with a dull thud. Military World sounded like a tacky, low-rent souvenir operation. She had professional standards. She did not work for people who collected and sold reproductions. On the other hand, this was Fantasy Man. In spite of Vesta's warning, she was determined to encourage future assignments with Lost and Found. Sometimes you had to lower your standards a notch. Business was business. When do you want me in Vegas? She asked, pen poised above the pad.
As soon as possible. How about tomorrow morning?
Yes. I'll have to check my schedule, she said smoothly. But I seem to recall that I'm free tomorrow. And if she wasn't free? She would cancel whatever appointment stood in the way of meeting Fantasy Man in person. 2. The ranks of medieval warriors, forever frozen in their steel carapaces, loomed behind him in the shadows. Mac Easton's face was as unreadable as that of any of the helmeted figures standing guard on the other side of the office window. There was something about Easton that made him appear locked in time, too, Katie thought. A quality of stillness, perhaps. You had to look twice to see him there in the shadows. If it hadn't been for the glow of the computer screen reflecting off the strong, fierce planes of his face and glinting on the lenses of his glasses, he would have been invisible. Not a youthful face, she thought. Definitely mature, but not too mature. 39 or possibly 40, a good age, an interesting age. At least it looked interesting on Mac Easton. The weird thing was that, even though she had never been able to imagine an exact image of him with only the telephone connection to go on, now that she was actually face-to-face with him, she could see that he fit the voice perfectly. Take the serious, dark-rimmed glasses, for example. Never in a million years would she have thought to add that touch if she had been asked to draw a picture of him based on their long-distance conversations. but when he had removed them from his pocket a few minutes ago and put them on, she had decided they looked absolutely right on him.
"We have a photograph," he said. "It was found in the museum's archives."
Museum was not the word she would have used to dignify Military World, she thought. What was she doing here? She must have been temporarily out of her mind last night when she took Easton's call. She was at home in hushed galleries, art research libraries, and the cluttered back rooms of prestigious auction salons. She mingled with connoisseurs and educated collectors. Military World, with its low-budget reproductions of arms and armor from various wars, was very much as she had envisioned it. Tacky. Then again, maybe that was just her personal bias showing. She had never been overly fond of armor. To her, it symbolized all that was brutish and primitive in human nature. The fact that the artisans of the past had devoted enormous talent and craftsmanship to its design and decoration struck her as bizarre. The office in which they sat belonged to the two owners of Military World, a pair that went by the names of Notch and Dewey. They hovered anxiously in the shadows, having surrendered the single desk to Easton and his laptop computer. Mac occupied the space behind the desk as if he owned it. She got the impression that was the way it was with any place he happened to inhabit at any particular moment. Something that just sort of happened to him, something he took for granted. She wished that she could get a better look at his eyes, but the reflection on his glasses concealed them as effectively as the steel helmets hid the features of the armored figures beyond the windows. He pushed the photograph toward her across the battered desk and reached out to switch on the small desk lamp. She watched, unwillingly fascinated, as the beam fell on one large, powerful-looking hand. No wedding ring, she noticed. Not that you could be sure a man was unmarried just because he didn't happen to wear a ring. With an effort, she tore her gaze away from his hand and focused on the photo. It featured a horse and rider garbed in flamboyantly styled armor that looked as if it had been designed for a video game or dreamed up by an artist for the cover of a science fiction fantasy novel. She recognized it as a fairly accurate reproduction of the elaborately embellished armor crafted during the Renaissance. Such impractical styles had never been intended for the battlefield. They had been created for the sole purpose of making the wearer look good in ceremonies, festivals, and parades. The photo itself was an amateurish shot, poorly lit, the kind of picture that a tourist might have snapped with a throwaway camera. She looked up and peered into the shadows where Easton's face was supposed to be. All she could see was the hard angle of a grim jaw and the hollows beneath high, ascetic cheekbones. There was nothing soft or open about him. She had the feeling that Easton had learned long ago not to expect too much from the world other than what he could seize for himself. 15th century, judging from the helmet and breastplate, she said, Italian in style. In style was a polite way of saying reproduction. I'm aware of that, Miss Briggs, Easton said with icy patience. But if you look closely, you can see a portion of another display behind the horse's, rear. She took a closer look. Sure enough, if she looked past the tail of the fake horse, she could just make out the dimly lit image of a standing figure garbed in heavily decorated steel. Half armor, she murmured. It was always good policy to impress the client, even if you weren't particularly interested in the job. Word of mouth was important. In the style of the northern Italian armors of the 16th century. Looks like part of a garniture meant for jousting at the barriers. Suits of armor from this era often consisted of dozens of supplementary and interchangeable pieces that allowed the set to be modified for specific uses, sort of like a modern all-in-one toolkit.
It's the helmet that we're interested in here, Max said.
She peered at it. The bad lighting made it difficult to see much detail.
What about it? It's the only piece that was stolen.
She looked up. Is there a better photo around? One of the two men who hovered near the far end of the desk, the individual who went by the name Dewey, edged closer with a crab-like movement.
Lucky to have that one, he said, sounding apologetic.
She could only guess at Dewey's age. His face was a worn and weathered map that could have belonged to a man of 50 or 70. He was dressed in military surplus, complete with camouflage fatigues.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?